Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
To another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's returning guest, director of films such as The Living and the Dead, Red, White and Blue, and the fantastic Crowhurst, is Simon Rumley. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Great to be back. I think I was trying to work it out. I think it's my third time, maybe.
I think it is. Well, third time lucky is a phrase. I wouldn't say that about coming to my podcast. But third time...
Yeah, neither of them were unlucky, so...
But third time, a change of medium. We are going to talk about three films that impacted everything in your life. But before we do, we're going to talk about your debut novel, The Wobble Club, which is about a morbidly obese South London couple and what happens when one goes on a diet and the other refuses.
That's right.
Now, that's published on the 26th of October by White Fox Publishing. Is that right?
That is very right, yeah.
And I'll put links in the show notes. People can pre-order on various places where you pre-order stuff, but I'll put a link that I've got for one of them. I guess, given that you're obviously more known for your filmmaking, why can I start with the very big basic question of why write a novel, not make a film?
Yeah. Basically, between 2013 and 2019, I made four feature films, and they were each a nightmare in different ways. And two of which I remain very creatively happy with them. Two of which I don't. And the distribution on one was impossible. You know, it was bought by our main competitors, who then tried to bury it. That being Studio Canal.
Mm-hmm.
I put, as most directors do, you know, that their soul and their heart and their life into making things, films that we think are going to be great and good, and that everyone's going to, you know, be as passionate about as you are. And in the end, this never really quite pans out. And so after doing these four films, none of which, as I said, were very easy, I was like, I really need a sabbatical from this or a rest, because I've kind of lost my belief in making films and working with people. And, you know, you think people automatically know what a good film is. Of course, most people don't. Otherwise, every film that was ever made would be really good, which has
indeed,
been
used. Indeed. We'd put it in a bottle. We'd bottle it and sell it, wouldn't we? If we knew what the formula was.
Exactly. So I'd had this idea for quite a while, to be honest. And, you know, I've been writing scripts since about 24, but actually before I wrote my first script, I actually, after I left university, wrote a novel, which remains unpublished to this day. But at that point, at the age of 22, I was like, actually, I think I was 21, actually. I was like, you know what? I either want to become a film director or a novelist. And so at that point, writing a novel seemed the easiest thing to do. So I did write a novel. And at the time, it was a very, as it still is to a point, it's an isolating experience. because you spend all the time by yourself. But nonetheless, I enjoyed the experience and was very proud to have written a novel, and always at some point wanted to go back and write another novel, or maybe even more than another novel. So it just, this seemed like the perfect timing, really, the perfect storm.
Okay. So what for you, what was the interest in The Morbidly Obese? Where does the kernel of that idea begin for you that then becomes the novel that we're going to see on the 26th of October?
I think I'm not entirely sure exactly when I had the idea, but it was definitely a good few years ago. And since then, well, I guess at my height, which was actually after shooting and editing and actually pretty much spending on and off a year in Louisiana and more specifically New Orleans,
okay,
where the portions of food are just like crazy.
And all fried.
And all fried, yeah, like literally. I mean, you know, obviously not everything, but a lot of it is. And it's you know, it's great food, but and you know, one doesn't want to waste stuff. So, but it's just like you have to go there to actually quite understand how big everything is. And so I came back and I you know, I was at my kind of definitely the peak of my weight, and you know, a lot of my clothes weren't fitting me, and I was. You know, struck. Well, I was, you know, trying to walk up the tube and just like sweating at the top of it. And at some point, my girlfriend is German, and she fasts, like as in she stops eating for in anything from 5 to 10 days.
Blimey.
And at some point, you know, this fascination of kind of me eating and actually really enjoying it, drinking, of course, and enjoying it, and actually being a massive chocolate fan and sweet fan, and eating, you know, sometimes eating 2 or 3 chocolate bars a day, kind of combined with my fascination with addiction, and then actually also in the end me losing a bit of weight, and then me actually. I was inspired by my girlfriend to fast as well.
Mm.
And at some point all this kind of came together and I was like, wow, you know, what an interesting idea. It was very much that one sentence, as they call, you know, the Hollywood pitch, the elevator pitch, you know, what happens when a morbidly obese couple, when one of the guys wants to go on a diet and his partner refuses, it's like, bang, you're in there. You know, because it's all the tension, drama, conflict, upset, pain, intrigue that comes from that. And it's very, you know, immediate pitch. And you know, as you know, a lot of my films are also, well, a lot of my work is psychological.
Mm.
And this is also, you know, a very psychological thing. You know, what makes people eat so much that they can hardly move?
No, it was interesting. I was asking a friend of mine who'd recently lost all the weight about for some advice, and he said this method he'd done, the words he used were, it completely changed my relationship to food.
Yeah. Well, what did he do?
He did the Noom, which I think has got a bit of, I think it's more calorie counting, but yeah. You also learn how to fill yourself up without needing to do all the calories at the same time.
It's you know, to me it's an endlessly fascinating subject, because you know, and we're talking not people who are overweight here, we're talking, just to qualify, the morbidly obese again. I don't, you know, in the book I never use the phrase morbidly obese. But the guy is like 42 stone and the woman is 36 stone.
Blimey, all right.
And one of the things that actually encourages the guy who's called Broly to go on a diet or some kind of diet is that his best mate, who's about 46 stone, has to have, well, both his legs amputated, and decides that he doesn't want to, he has one leg amputated, but decides he doesn't want to have both of them amputated. So does, you know, a Nicolas Cage leaving Las Vegas, but rather than drinking himself to death, he decides, you know, in a very positive way, to actually eat himself to death.
Blimey.
So that's the inspiration for our hero Broly to actually say, you know what, fuck it, I don't actually want this to happen to me. So I'm going to try and do something about it.
Brilliant. One last question about the book. What for you was the sort of biggest storytelling challenge pulling this together? But you know, if you're dealing with the psychology of our relationship with food, you know, what necessarily makes that dramatic and psychological? What was the challenges there for you?
Well, you know, like a lot of my stuff, it starts off, you know, very much try to set the characters in a reality. But I push everything to the extreme. But because hopefully they've been based in a reality, you know, the extreme of what happens is still believable, and actually does go dark, increasingly dark, and does go, you know, Stephen King horror to a point, which you'll know what I mean if you read it. So in terms of I think in terms of, you know, the complexity of writing it, in the end the novel is 112,000 words, which is not short for novels.
Yeah.
It's obviously isn't one piece, but it's a longer novel. I think for me, because I think more in terms of scenes, and you know, you can knock out, you know, 10, 15 scenes in a day, depending on how long they are. But with writing a novel, I found myself writing a lot of stuff that in the end I didn't use. So actually I wrote about 200,000 words.
So you were killing your darlings even when you had that, when it didn't matter, because the novel obviously doesn't have the same restrictions as the sort of natural process of making a movie, because people are aware of time as much as anything else that costs money, whereas a book doesn't have the same constraints, does it?
No, you're exactly right. And you know, having shot films and having edited, you know, or at least, you know, co-edit all my films, one of the satisfying things actually is to edit your stuff and literally take stuff out, because you only take stuff out that you really don't think, you know, helps the story. So because I've done that, you know, throughout my whole life with films, it was, even though it was kind of kind of annoying, frankly, that I wrote so much and then cut so much out, but nonetheless, it's everything, you know, whether it's films or novels, it's like, you know, what works for the plot and what
and
works
and so
for the
story. And I guess, you know, I mean, I've only experienced writing screenplays, but you know, you have to write what isn't right and see it that it's not right before you can discount it. You know, an idea is always worth trying, and that's
absolutely. And you know, and when I write scripts, I have something that Final Draft has never done, which I don't know why, because I'm sure I can't be the first person to come up with this. But well, you know, I often, as we all do, write scenes, which then, you know, I don't use or then I take out. But I have to, you know, then save them as a file in Final Draft, and then I put them in a folder which, you know, which I call reject scenes. But yeah, you know, it's relatively easy to write a scene. You know, it may take you an hour, it may take you half an hour. And if you don't, or it's, you know, it may take you 10 minutes. And if you don't like it, it's like, well, sometimes it takes you 5. But, you know, in the end, you're like, well, whatever. That doesn't work. I'm scrapping it. But with a novel, you know, you can write, you know, a chapter, you can write 5 pages. You know, in reality, if you write 5 pages, I mean, I don't know how quick I am, but you know, that quite possibly will take me a day to write.
Yeah.
So suddenly, if I write, let's say, 40 scenes in a film script, which I then take out, that may be, you know, in total a day and a half's writing, over maybe a month of writing. If I do that in terms of novel, it's actually, it's a lot longer. So that was, yeah, for me, that was, you know, it's part of the process. And I'd like to think, you know, if I do write another book, which I hope I will, you know, I'll understand the process a little bit better and be a little bit better at not writing a crazy amount of words, which half of which I then cut out anyway.
Well, look, congratulations on your debut novel, The Wobble Club, available from the 26th of October from White Fox Publishing. And now we're going to move into 3 films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Now, for those people that haven't heard this format before and are tuning in for the first time, Simon has given me 3 film titles. He's going to talk to me about the memories that they hold for him, and we're only going to do that for 5 minutes. Film number one in the list you gave me, doing it in the order that you did give me the films, I'm going to start with 1986's Stand By Me. What is it about that film? What memories does that hold? Where did you see that for the first time? Who did you see it with?
Well, I think I was 20, 21. I saw it in the Tunbridge Wells, whatever the cinema was called in Tunbridge Wells, which I saw films growing up in. And I think I saw it with my friend Karen Harris and I think Chris Baker. And I think afterwards we went to maybe a Pizza Hut or something like that.
Okay.
And yeah, it's a film that has stayed with me ever since. It's, you know, and as it has with a lot of people, I think. And as you know, a lot of my films that I do are pretty kind of hardcore and psychologically tough and stuff. And there's something, even though the content of what this is about, you know, kids going to, looking for a dead body, it's such a beautiful film, and it just captures that kind of moving out of childhood and into kind of adulthood really well. And it's literally on the cusp of that, I think. And I think for me, I at the time, you know, in my teenage years, and probably up until 21-ish, I was a rockabilly, or a psychobilly, depending on which way I combed my hair. But you know, I was a big fan of rock and roll as well, which is and you know, Elvis and Eddie Cochran and you know, Buddy Holly and stuff, and so anything that set during that point in time, and specifically with that kind of music, was something that I immediately kind of had some kind of affection towards, and the soundtrack of that is of course all that kind of music. So that was a great starter for me. I guess in the end, you know, it was also, you know, the lead character, I suppose. I can't say often I look at films and go, hey, that's kind of me, or identify with that character that much. But I think, you know, I think it was Gordy LaChance, I think was his name. And you know, he was such a kind of every kid kind of thing, and you know, he was the one who, you know, with, you know, everyone around him seemed mad, or they seemed kind of from the wrong side of the tracks, but they were friends, and he just seemed like the normal kid, but he was still struggling, of course, with his brother's death, so he wasn't as normal as he may have seemed, and I didn't have a brother who died, of course, but there was something about him I think I just, you know, felt a great empathy for, really, and of course you've then got some, you know, the great cameos of Ace, the character who played Ace,
Kiefer Sutherland.
Kiefer Sutherland. There you go. So is this kind of another film which not dissimilar, although I watched when I was older, because it was released later, was Dazed and Confused. But I guess when I watched it, you know, again, even though the film was set in America, in a part of America that I'd never been to and probably still haven't, it just felt like it was something that I could have gone through as my childhood and my kind of coming of age, and you know, that just hanging out with your mates and chatting and talking, and you know, the whole thing, you know, girls are coming into the conversation, and you're starting to, you know, you are starting to grow into a man, and the kind of life that they had, which was, well, actually all the characters are fairly complicated, which is, again, you know, one of the great things about the script. But, you know, nonetheless, in terms of them and how they then grew up and what they became as adults, you know, that was still, and that's probably what the film's about, you know, that there was such a kind of innocence to them and naivety and just kind of, you know, that beauty of friendship and just taking things for what they are, you know, rather than being, you know, that then affected actually by you know, things that we're affected for by the rest of our lives, and you know, when bitterness comes in and stuff. So there's such a lot there, I think, in terms of what's going on.
I don't know what you, Simon, but I think that the film captures that, like, the space race that you're in when you're a young person to become an adult, and then the different rates at which your group of friends, because obviously you grow up with friends and you grow up differently, you grow up at different rates. So suddenly you've got the one who's smoking, drinking before anyone else has even thought about doing something remotely rebellious, let alone picking up bad habits. And also, I think one of the things that stands out when rewatching this film now as an adult, as obviously I saw it as a kid myself, is the lack of influence of adults. It's that real sort of Lord of the Flies element to it, which is kids looking after themselves. And obviously, when they come across Ace's gang, it's like Ace's gang is the big bad baddies.
Yeah.
And that's our 5 minutes. While I was in the middle of just giving you my thoughts on it.
Well, it was great. Great to hear your thoughts. But I love that film, and it's I watched a lot when I was, you know, over the years, and I haven't watched it for a long, long time, but I actually watched a couple of, well, you know, I think around the time we started talking.
And
sometimes films hold up, sometimes they don't, but to my mind, it holds up perfectly, and it's a very good, funny, tight script as well.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
It's a good 90 minutes, and
the dialogue's great.
A bit like it was weird. It's weird that you mentioned Days Confused, because in a way, they both benefit from the fact that they were made out of time from when they're set. I mean, in other words, they're period. Yeah. They're essentially period dramas, but they're period dramas not going back to Victoriana or the wild frontiers. It's just within somebody's living memory. But the fact is, within somebody's living memory, it's a recycled version of it. So therefore, when you do get the chance to go back to it, it's not a kind of snapshot of that time at all. It's somebody's memory of what that time was. So
and with that comes a nostalgia and you know, a kind of almost a rose tintedness even though the, you know, Stand By Me, you know, there's a lot of dark stuff going on. I love it, and you know, it remains one of my favorite films.
And going back 10 years then, and maybe a selection that people who know your work might be more expecting to see in the list is Scorsese's Taxi Driver from 1976. Do you want to tell us where that fits in your film memories? Where have you banked it in terms of how you feel?
Well, I've back in the day when there were good old video shops and video nosters and all the video shops were, you know, that they smelt of nicotine, and there was a bunch of weirdos who just kind of seemed to, you know, hang out there and work there and, you know, wear dirty coats there and stuff. I guess I was probably 13, or maybe 14 actually. So I got this from my local video shop, also in Tunbridge Wells, right near to where my dad worked. And
do you remember the name of your video shop?
No. I don't actually. I remember it had a yellow logo. That's about as much as I remember.
Okay, go on.
And I remember that the woman who worked there was had long white bedraggled hair. I guess it was blonde, and she was a real smoker, and she was a bit of a character, really. So I do remember her. And so the crazy thing was, a week before, I'd gone in there with my dad, and you know we're watching, you know, we're looking at all the labels, and he's like, you know, what do you want? What do you think? And I was like, I don't know. And then I saw The Exorcist, and I said, oh, look, I've heard this is quite good. And this is why I was literally 13. And so he was like, oh, yeah, I've heard that's pretty good as well. Should we get that then? So I was like, yeah, okay. You know, neither of us obviously had a clue what it was about. So we went home, watched this with my mum. And you know, we were, you know, a nuclear English family kind of thing. And of course, when that, you know, that scene came on, you could literally, well, apart from the actual noise that the film was making, you know, I could feel my parents tighten up and tension, and I could and stuff, and you know, there's a whole masturbation thing. And in credit to my parents, we all watched it, finished the film, and never spoke about The Exorcist again. But next week I got Taxi Driver out by myself. Didn't know really anything about it. Of course, why would I? I was 13. I hadn't seen a trailer or anything.
So what drew you to it then? If you knew nothing about it, what do you remember being the attraction?
I might have heard of it. I used to go to the video shop probably every week.
Yeah.
And so you know, and whilst there was always new titles, of course, there's always a lot of the old titles. So at some point, you know, you kind of saw covers. And of course, you know, New York, I guess the cover's probably, you know, Robert De Niro walking along a New York street with his hands in his pockets. And it's not what you would sell as an image, but it's such a cool image in a way.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, even then it felt, I guess, a little bit iconic in its own way. And I guess I must have read, you know, I could read, of course. I was quite good at school. I guess I must have read what it was about, thought, you know, hey, that sounds kind of cool, you know. So I watched that film at home by myself. And what's the funniest thing was both my parents came in separately, saw some of the scenes and said, what are you watching this time? And I had to say, well, it's a really good film. And they said, hey, for God's sake, we'll just... My dad said, "Oh, for God's sake, just don't tell your mum." My mum was like, "Oh, for God's sake, just don't tell your dad." Again, another relatively hardcore film for a 13-year-old to watch. But again, you know, I loved it, and I think at some point I bought it on video, and I had the big poster of those massive kind of 6-foot posters which I had in my bedroom, which somehow I lost over the years, which I'm still a bit pissed off about. But I watched it like, you know, 25 times over the years. And of course, you know, I guess everyone who's seen it, you know, pretty much, oh, actually, yeah, you know, pretty much everyone, you know, loves it really. So for me, probably, you know, what I love about it's probably the same as most people, but, you know, of course, Robert De Niro is so, you know, he's cool in it, he's dangerous, he's unhinged, but you empathize with him, you know, and of course, the politician, you know, all politicians are evil. What's interesting, of course, is this guy. It's not like in, you know, The Dead Zone, where actually the politician, the was it Martin Sheen character, you know, is proven to be evil, and so his death is like a good thing. In the Taxi Driver, you actually never. You know, the politician is, relatively speaking, an okay guy compared with all the other kind of nutcases and characters and stuff. But, you know, Robert De Niro, you know, he's the anti-hero, really. Shit, I've got to stop again.
He is an anti-hero, and it's what's interesting. I think in a way, given the way Paul Schrader wrote the screenplay, that the politician might not be a bad person himself, but I suppose Travis Bickle is a victim of the state.
Politicians. Yeah, no, of course.
Whether we know he did or he didn't go to war, he's certainly damaged. So the understanding is he's been, I don't think he ever mentions he's been to war, but the understanding is that he's post-Vietnam, isn't he? And he's just been basically thrown the heap.
Yeah. And you know, and the whole depiction of, you know, street life and just, it was like people living, you know, like animals. And of course, you know, there's the Clash song, you know, where they quote lyrics from it, you know, and you know, the one about the people, the rain washing away all the scum on the streets and stuff. And actually the Clash are mentioned in the credits, or thanked in the credits. And I've never quite got to the bottom of why, but I think, you know, he went to see them when they played in New York at Bonds Square or something, like some sold out, you know, 60 night residency. So there's that. And then there's the, you know, there's a sexuality of it. Again, I was, you know, again, becoming more of an adult, you know, and
if you, I mean, as well as what, 5 years later, or is it 4 years later, you get the pure exploitation version of this, the Exterminator, which is about as subtle as a brick in the face. I mean, still a very fun film from its time, but it's still, and my first trip to New York was 1995. So that's 20 years, more or less 20 years as this film was shot. And that kind of 42nd Street had more or less vanished, you know, the whole kind of cesspit of America that would have been in New York. And that, and thinking about the time, you know, 76, 77 was more or less when New York went bankrupt. You know,
And you know what? And I only really kind of realized this quite recently. And after watching all those films and, you know, The Warriors and you know, Fort Apache, The Bronx and whatever else, it's like, I saw a film called Wolfen, I think it is. And it's set in the Bronx, and it looks like you know, Berlin Germany post Second World War. It's absolutely flattened, razed to the ground, and you're like, hang on, this was shot in the late 70s, and it's incredible. And this is something that people don't quite realize how fucked up New York was. And of course, you know, I'm no expert, but you do watch some of these films, and the lawlessness is there. For sure. And there's actually an amazing, if you're into that kind of stuff and going back to, you know, well, what isn't there on 42nd Street? Well, there's a guy called Legs McNeil who compiled a book called The Oral History of Porn. And a lot of that is, it's essentially set between LA and New York. But that is a lot about, you know, all the sex theaters and what went on. And it's just like a crazy, crazy time. Which, you know, it's so far away from now.
Absolutely,
it's unbelievable.
I recently saw Betty Gordon's film Variety from 1983, which is very much, a female's point of view of a similar New York with a female protagonist.
Interesting.
It's just got a reissue. It's just literally been reissued on its 40th anniversary, and I'd never heard of it, and watching it at the BFI, it's fantastic, because you get that, you get what you get now when you look at Taxi Driver, you get that social history, which a film, you know, whereas we're talking about the nostalgia that permeates through Stand By Me, both Taxi Driver and Variety, for that matter, become social history documents of a time, like timestamping New York, that doesn't exist anymore. Because, I mean, Christ, by the time, I mean, 95, it was changing. Then I remember going in 2000 to do a news article for a magazine. And I was walking from Madison Square Gardens through to Avenue C. You know, my guidebook that I had from the 90s had said, never go east of Avenue A. And there I am, just wandering through New York and not caring, because a bit like the way London's changed under our feet while we've been living here the last God knows how many decades.
Absolutely. Well, and the Lower East Side, of course, is actually where which is what you're kind of talking about, kind of east of, you know, the Alphabet Avenues and stuff. That's kind of, you know, that became like hyper trendy, and that's where Moby opens, you know, his vegan or vegetarian restaurant, and that's kind of where the Strokes started playing. And
you got that whole kind of Williamsburg thing and all that came after that. And look, moving swiftly along, but not going as far forward as Stand By Me, we're going to go to 1984 for Gremlins. Another choice that surprised me when I saw this on your list. So go on, talk to me about where this fits in with the Simon Rumley
watching films. These are films that I saw when I was youngster. So, you know, I did see films like, well, The Exorcist, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but Gremlins was, you know, and I thought I'd better choose one kind of horror-ish kind of film. And Gremlins, I was at school. So again, I was probably like 14 or so. And I think at the time, it was the only film that I saw in the cinema twice. So I went with all my mates from school. I think I'd seen it by myself, or no, with a friend, and then suggested that I went with my friends from school because we had a Christmas outing every year kind of thing. So we went to see that. And again, you know, going back to the rock and roll stuff, you know, it starts with, you know, rocking Ricky Rialto playing the Ronettes, you know, the best Christmas song ever. It's not the Ronettes, is it? It's actually, who's it about? Baby Come Home. But you know the one. And I love snow. So it's set in, you know, I love Christmas. I love snow. And Phoebe Cates, I just had an immediate crush on when I saw her. Again, as I guess I wasn't the only one.
I don't think you were alone.
I didn't think I was alone. Exactly. And you know, that small town Americana, again, I love. So it was setting the scene very well. And of course, Corey Feldman's in it, who was also in Stand By Me. And actually in another one of my favorite films of my growing up is The Lost Boys. So, you know, he was in like three of my all-time favorite films, to be honest. He's got a slightly lesser role to Zach Galligan's lead. But you know, he's always great. And then of course, you know, there's Gizmo, and it's such a kind of, it's a kind of crazy conceit, of course, but it never felt like science fiction, you know, in a way that so many of these things, like you know, the Blob or whatever, is like, you know, or The Day of the Triffids, you know, they're science fiction, but somehow Mogwai and kind of, you know, felt like it could be real, because it's a little bit like, you know, pet that you know hamster between a cat or whatever, and something that you could kind of communicate with. And it's so sweet. And I'm not a massive animal lover, to be honest, but you know, you can't not kind of love that little Gizmo. And then of course, you know, so there were all these great setups, and then of course, bit by bit, you know, and those three rules, you know, was it don't you know, don't feed them after, was it don't feed
them after midnight?
Midnight. Don't put them in water. Can't remember what the other one was. It's such a brilliantly written script, and it's that perfect kind of example of what is a good Hollywood script. You know, for all the films I love, like, you know, the Jodorowsky films or David Lynch films or Shinya Sakamoto films, you know, which kind of really don't always pay that much attention to the rules. You know, this kind of works on every kind of, you know, thriller beat. And it's really kind of, you know, from beginning to end, it's just.
And you've got Joe Dante, one of the original masters of horror, directing it. And on the one hand, it's a cutesy. Certainly the first half of the movie, it's a cutesy, almost like a family entertainment movie. But it does go for the horror, doesn't it? Even though you've got that kind of cute hamster thing in the second half of the movie, the gremlins are quite nasty. It's not, you know, obviously it's fantasy, but it plays like a horror film.
Well, no, and this is a, you know, again, it's the best horror film for, you know, kids and teenagers ever, really, because it is, you know, it is kind of at times, if you're a little bit younger, you know, kind of scary, because, you know, they're a bunch of marauding, you know, kind of, you know, miscreants, really, and all they want to do is you know, smash things up and hurt people. So, you know, so the danger of the gremlins, you know, once you get Stripe and stuff, is absolutely real. And actually, I like gremlins so much that I, on my kind of, on the back of my leather biker jacket, I got someone in Hull Market, where I was at university, to paint a gremlin that was a Stripe, and it was an amazing job. And I'm really, again, when I lost my taxi driver posters, I don't know if I lost them or someone nicked them. I kind of feel the latter. But I lost my biker jacket with the gremlin on the back of it, which is, again, to this day, I'm still a bit annoyed about. Yep, sorry.
We're on our last 5 minutes are up, sir.
No.
I mean, it's interesting because if I remember rightly, it plays on a kind of Eastern mysticism as the origins of the Gremlin, whereas all the knockoffs, like the Critters, the Ghoulies, and all that kind of stuff, it became this idea of something from outer space has come to Earth and we're all going to pay the price if we don't defend ourselves. Yep. Whereas there's this lovely cutesy thing that if you play by the rules, you'll have a cutesy thing forever, but be warned. And also being a Christmas movie made it kind of give it that little, the other little aside.
And you're right, you know, and it's almost like a kind of, in its own way, some kind of Zen Buddhist metaphor or you know, for life, you know, abide by these rules and everything will be fine. You know, disregard these rules and your life won't be fine.
Just thinking there of the Gremlins being like a guide for Stoics.
I like it. There's a novel for someone there. And the other thing that, you know, I also liked, which I think at the time I didn't quite get it, but at some point I was like, fuck, of course they have clips of It's a Wonderful Life, you know, with Jamie Stewart running through the Christmas town. So that kind of, you know, that double reference is nice. And of course Spielberg produced it. So, to my mind, it's another, you know, perfect film, to be honest. You know, I don't think there's anything, you know, it's just like flawless, and which you can't say that about.
You won't find any argument from me. Well, look, thank you for sharing three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. We heard you talk about Stand By Me, Taxi Driver, and Gremlins. And before we started that conversation, we had a chat about your debut novel, The Wobble Club, which is out on the 26th of October, 2023. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for joining us on the Britflix podcast.
Hey, well, thank you for having me. As always, it's a pleasure. I look forward to time number 4.
Indeed.
Another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.